Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. Hi, folks. Welcome to episode 100 of the Epochs of the Load Seasons. I'm joined by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about Sargon of Akkad, the first proper emperor that we can identify in history. Now, before we begin, this was about 4,500 years ago, so the evidence that we have is basically mythical, very fragmentary, but we'll do our best with what we've got, because it seems that he cast a very, very long shadow through the millennia in the Middle East, and this is why I thought he was an interesting character when I very first started on YouTube, frankly. So where do you want to begin?
Yeah, well, just to say episode 100, the last couple of epochs I've been sort of leading up to this. Göbekli Tepe and then Sumeria and then Sargon. Yeah, it's fair to say he's the first emperor that we know of anyway.
So just before we go on, one thing that's dicey to define is the concept of empire, right? Actually,
yeah.
Because lots of things have claimed to be empires, which haven't been, and lots of things have claimed not to be empires, which clearly are. I have always used the definition that an empire is the supremacy of one ethnic group over others.
Right, so that's it. If it's sort of the word national doesn't make any sense in these days,
yeah.
But if it's multinational, multi-ethnic,
yes,
then you can start to call it an empire.
But it also has to have the clear supremacy of one ethnic group over the other, which is why you can say the Delian Confederation turned into the Athenian Empire when the treasury was moved from Delos to Athens. Then it was suddenly the supremacy of Athens over these other city-states. Mm. And this is why Voltaire's right about the Holy Roman Empire not being an empire, actually, because it's all Germans, basically. This is why kingdoms aren't empires as well, because they're ethnically homogenous, or cohesive. So that's the definition I use of empire, which I think is fair.
Yeah, and just quickly to say the Holy Roman Empire was very, very unholy and not at all Roman.
No.
But there you go. People argue about that. I've seen the argument. It's exactly the Holy Roman Empire. It's exactly what it is.
Who's on the other side of the argument, though?
Weirdo comment people on YouTube.
Okay.
Anyway.
They're wrong.
So just to put it in its context, we are the reign of Sargon I, Sargon the Great,
yes,
is at least nominally, we can't even be sure of the exact, but we're told, scholars tell us that it's 2334 BC, of course, to 2279 BC. So over 50 years.
Yeah.
That's a good innings. It's such a good innings.
That's good innings for now.
Right. You start to think,
but conversely, right?
It's totally possible.
Well, A, it's plausible. B, there was an Egyptian pharaoh who's said to have reigned for longer. And C, it's not 28,000 years, right?
Right, yeah. Which the first Sumerian king lists say.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. So I'm actually more inclined to believe that may be something, again, like the exact dates and numbers are always going to be off when you're looking this far back into the murky depths of history. But about 50 years is not unbelievable, actually. Mm. So,
yeah, there's this idea, which is totally true, that people lived a lot shorter lives in the past, certainly in the deep past. That's definitely true. But it's also true to say that it wasn't unheard of that people would live to be in their 70s, 80s, or even 90s.
Yes.
Sometimes it was a lot rarer, but it totally happened.
Another
to have him live into his 70s, say, and rise to power in his 20s, that's not completely absurd at all.
No, not at all. And one thing that people need to remember about when we say, well, people used to die a lot younger in the past, that is true, but also a lot of those deaths are very young, and that kind of disproportionately weights the average mortality, the average life expectancy of someone living 1,000 years ago. Mm. As you said, they are completely capable of living into the 70s and 80s, and many of them do so. Mm. And we have lots of examples of historical figures who have done this. Mm. So it's really not extreme. And I think a lot of it, right, is actually that a lot of the time they would have had a fairly decent diet.
Yeah.
I know that sounds like a silly thing, but actually what you eat really matters.
Yeah. is it Aeschylus? I think Aeschylus lived to be in his 90s, sort of fairly definitely recorded to have been in his 90s. So again, it was rare, but it could happen. Also, people, if you made it out of infancy, you were strong. You were physically strong. You probably had a very good immune system in the ancient world if you made it out of infancy.
Yeah.
And if you got lucky, you didn't get, you know, any sort of...
Tuberculosis, or you didn't get
blood poisoning from some little nick or something.
Yeah.
Then you could certainly live, if you didn't get infection from your teeth.
Yeah.
Just like an animal. I mean, people died from their teeth a lot.
Yeah.
Just like animals do.
Yeah. Wasn't Socrates like 72 when they put him to death?
Right, yeah, he was an old man.
Yeah, you know, there's old people exist in the ancient world. There are just fewer of them.
Right. So Sargon of Akkad, to call him, to have the Akkadian Empire, to call him the first emperor, it seems pretty clear, if you believe the accounts, if you don't say it's just all propaganda, or
and
it's
it could
all
be
made
myth.
Up. It could be. Because most of the accounts are from long after he was supposed to have lived.
Yeah, literally thousands of years in some cases.
But if you believe it, then he did rule over a multi-ethnic state.
And this is another important point as well. It was an imperial state, as in had administrators and a bureaucracy and regional governors who resided over cities and provinces and who answered directly to Sargon. So it definitely had an imperial structure.
Yeah, it seems to have done, absolutely. Mm. So it's kind of fair. I think it's totally fair to say the Akkadian Empire is the first, among the first, if not the first empire.
Yeah.
Another sort of definition, quite a fairly low resolution one, but I feel it serves, is that if you're an over king of many kings, you're an emperor.
Yeah, you can call that that.
Again, that's fairly low resolution, but you know, there you go. And that is exactly what Sargon did.
And this is why we can say that the you know, the Persian Shahrin Shah, the king of kings, was an emperor, really, in what we would, in the sort of modern political lexicon. And that's fair. I think that's totally fair.
Mm. So where last time we were talking about the Sumerians and we set up Lugal-Zaghezi, a Sumerian king.
Mm.
Well, he was a type of king of kings, some sort of over-king.
But he only ruled over Sumerian cities,
Well, that's right. Well, he... Okay, so his story is bound up with Sargon's.
Mm.
So to get into him a bit, historians, scholars do seem to think that the proclamations we've got of him, his sort of victory stelae and stuff, they do think that his are sort of fairly certainly exaggerated. That it, at least, maybe not out and out liars, not like complete propaganda, but... exaggerated, because he claims that he sort of conquered as far as the Mediterranean and stuff. Remember, we're talking about southern Iraq, southern Mesopotamia.
So it's about 1,000 miles.
So yeah, massive.
Yeah.
Did he really do that? I think that there's not really any archaeology that backs it up. Now that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
No.
Because archaeology, when it comes to warfare, is quite difficult, especially the further you go back. It's easy to show where there were walls there and where there were fires. And certain things in archaeology, you can say, yes, that's definitely it.
Mm.
But warfare is difficult. Unless you find sort of mass burials with like with large traumas all over the skeletons. Yeah. Or if you find like a massive cache of arrowheads or something. If you don't find that, then it's difficult to say.
One of the perennial problems that military historians have is actually identifying where the battlefield was. Because often it's you're given a description in the primary sources, but the landscape has changed in the intervening thousands of years.
Mm.
And as you say, actually, there's very little evidence. Like one of the I watched a documentary about this a while ago, and apparently on one hilltop near Thermopylae, they found a collection of bronze arrows. And that, okay, great, that gives us an indication that Leonidas, or not Leonidas, but the Spartans' sort of last stand where they get arrowed to death by the Persians. Well, that might be real, you know, because that's what the account says. And so if they find a bunch of arrowheads there, okay, great, that may well be true. But that's a very unique case where we can actually find, you know, point to the story, the location, and the evidence to back it up. Because normally it's just a few thousand guys on either side hacking each other up. And then the battlefield gets stripped by, because one thing people have got to remember as well, a battlefield in the ancient world, it was like it would be like coming across a sort of a field strewn with Lamborghinis, right? All of this armor, all of these shields, all of these swords, horses, chariots, these things cost the earth. These were the most expensive things in society you could buy because they were difficult to manufacture. And so if you got to loot a battlefield, you were going to walk away making a lot of money out of it.
Yeah, so definitely. Yeah, people would come across it like locusts.
Yeah.
Take anything of value.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time in the Middle Ages or the ancient world, men would have all their money on them.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So you could, they might have
they
their pockets
themselves,
filled
yeah.
with money, possibly, yeah. potentially.
Yeah. All the, and they'd definitely be wearing rings and, you know, necklaces and maybe gold teeth, things like this. Like it was, there was a lot of money on a battlefield.
But even if archaeologists do find on an sort of an ancient Mesopotamian archaeological dig, they do find a load of arrowheads, say, it could just be hunting. Yeah. It could just be in somewhere where they were manufacturing them. It doesn't mean that a battle happened there at all. It's very difficult to say a battle happened here. And you're absolutely right that even a great example of what we're talking about here is Agincourt.
Yeah.
That's only 500 odd years ago. And the field of Agincourt, the archaeology doesn't really show a battle happened there.
We assume that's the field because it's roughly in the location. It's got that upward incline. Mm. And so look, and it's muddy. And so it looks like it could be the field, but it could be one over there or one over there. Who knows?
And that's a mere 500 years ago. Mm. This is 4,000 years older than that.
Yeah.
So points in Sargon's career and life anyway. Mm. So for example, in Agincourt, it may just be that the accounts we've got are slightly wrong. I mean, it may be that the battlefield was absolutely stripped, but that seems unlikely. You would have thought there'd be, especially as muddy as the account says it was, that there would be quite a few things buried in the mud and doesn't really seem to be much or really anything there.
Hmm.
So it seems like somewhere along the way, through the centuries.
Yeah, you think there's some broken spurs or something would be
the story's
metal
just got,
detected.
Right.
Nothing's come up really.
Not really.
So you
would think at least there would be some mass burials. Mm. So again, somewhere along the way, the story, the location has been sort of lost. So for example, Sargon has his capital at various points along the way, but at some point he makes his capital Akkad.
Mm.
We don't know where that is.
No, it's a lost city.
Yeah, it's completely lost. Yeah. Assuming it existed, which it seems it almost certainly must have done, it's just somewhere in modern-day Iraq, central northern Iraq, and we don't know, it's not been found.
To the north of Babylon, probably not far up, but we don't know much about it.
Yeah. So to say that a whole city, which would have been the capital of an empire, and the empire lasts over 150 years, 180-odd years, this empire.
Yeah, which is a good innings for the very first empire.
Yeah. The centre of the world, in a way.
Yeah.
There's accounts that Sargon brought loads of treasures and possessions of his enemies to Akkad. It would have had a ziggurat and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
We got no idea where it is. So that gives people an idea. Just one last point to say on that. When it comes to history, sometimes people think, or it's easy to think, that we know a lot more than we really do.
Mm.
It's actually, and I'm not even talking far back, in the Middle Ages, we actually, it's sort of a very fragmentary story we've got. So, for example, if you go back to the pre-Tudor age, there's very few buildings left that are pre-Tudor.
Mm-hmm.
There's a handful.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, well, but I thought we sort of knew everything. Well, no, there's like a handful of Norman keeps.
That's only a few hundred years ago.
And there's right. So when you go back
and what's more, in a long settled and basically undisturbed country.
Mm.
And yet we, and in England, we totally value things that are ancient. We don't destroy them. We keep them because we think that they've accumulated worth purely through the age. And so if we don't have those things, you can imagine how difficult it is to find things from cultures that have been taken over by people who just don't care about the past.
Yeah.
Which has happened many times to Iraq.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, yeah. The amount of destruction and sort of deliberate trying to wipe out what came before in Iraq is mad, really.
Awful.
It's surprising that there's sort of any archaeology left in a way. But yeah, so that's why literary evidence is so unbelievably valuable. Because if we'd lost, for example, in the story of Sargon, if we'd lost all the literary evidence, he'd almost certainly be lost entirely.
We wouldn't even know his name.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So that's sort of a translation as well, Sargon. What he called himself was a different word. And
Sharu Kinu.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Which means legitimate king, which clearly is a throne name he's taken himself. Just say, what do we call you? Oh, just call me legitimate king. What do you mean? Well, that's my name. So, yeah, but what's your real name? Don't know. Just legitimate king.
Yeah.
That's what my mum called me, I guess.
That'll do. I'll take it.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, there's a little bit there. Maybe it's armchair psychology is a bit, but I've seen a fair few people say it, that speaks of, if you really were a legitimate king, you probably wouldn't need... That. Yeah, right.
But we know he's not the legitimate king.
Right.
That's the thing, you know. He's the first meritocrat, maybe.
Also, let's get into his story. Yeah, so okay, yeah. He isn't royal bull. He isn't born to the purple or anything, is he?
No,
if you believe his origin story.
He's a total orphan. He's just some random orphan. And so one thing I like about the Sargon legend is that he predates the mythos of Moses by at least 1,000 years, but has basically the same origin story. His mum was a priestess, I believe it was. Obviously wasn't supposed to have him. And so she puts him in a basket, seals it with bitumen, and floats him down the Euphrates. And at I think it's Kish... The royal gardener of Kish, called Aki, is just at the river one day, and this basket with a baby turns up. And he's like, oh, well, okay, I'll raise this baby, and I'll take care of this baby, because that's the right thing to do. And so Sargon is raised as a gardener, as the son of the royal gardener. And we don't really know what happens in Kish, but there is something that happens when Sargon's about 18. And then there's a break in the text, and suddenly he's the king. And we don't know what happened there. But that's a really, really fascinating story, because the social layering of the palace and the civilization itself would have been the king, a selection of very close nobles, a much larger noble class, then the servants, of which the gardener would have been one, and then the free peasants working the land, right? So Sargon wasn't someone who had familial connections. He wasn't someone who was entitled. He wasn't a lineal descendant of the king. He wasn't a member of a powerful noble family that could gather together the manpower to overthrow the king. And we don't really know what happened, apart from apparently Ishtar appears to him. It's really cute, actually, in the description, because you can tell the feeling of time that they have. Because Sargon is tasked by one of the, I think it's the blacksmith or something, to take a letter to someone else. And in the text, it says, this is in the time before envelopes were invented, but Sargon can't read. I think it's Ishtar interrupts him and says, right, you can't go into the temple because you're polluted with blood, which is, who knows what that means, right? But he ends up getting into some sort of... intercession with the deities, and then there's a break in the text and suddenly he's the king. So it seems that what it is the gods have decided that Sargon should be the king for some reason, which is obviously some post hoc rationalization of he overthrew something, right? Is Lugal Zagzi,
who with the message is Lugal
Zagzi. And he's ill as well. He's urinating himself, he's vomiting, and so he's incontinent, and so he's clearly sick and dying. And so I presume he doesn't have an heir or something like that?
I think maybe there's a bit more to the story.
Sorry,
I think
maybe, I'm just going off my memory.
Mixed up a couple of different characters
Yeah, go ahead.
Just to go back quickly, because you mentioned like 5 or 6things there already that could talk for 20 minutes about.
It's been ages since I've read it.
So just to mention his origin story and the parallels with Moses. Mm. It's not just Moses, is it? There's lots of stories.
No, there's loads. Yeah.
There's one from Egyptian mythology, or even Romulus and Remus have floated down a river and picked up by someone.
But the most obvious one being Moses, because of course of the Babylonian exile, which is clearly where the Israelites picked up the story.
So one thing to say right there, a lot of the Sargon story, not all of it, there are original cuneiform bits, fragments, but a lot of it is from the later Babylonian civilization, where they hark back and talk about him. So there's a bit that survives from the Babylonian times, so hundreds and hundreds of years later, maybe 1,000 years later. And they put words in the mouth of Sargon, which obviously is another technique, which, you know, modern historians say obviously he probably didn't say these exact words. But anyway, we have him saying of himself, my mother was a high priestess, my father I knew not. The brothers of my father loved the hills. My city is Azupiranu,
which is Sidhu.
Yeah, yeah. which is situated on the banks of the Euphrates. My high priestess mother, sometimes I've seen it, the translation called a changeling, but that's a convoluted way of saying a priestess, I suppose. My high priestess mother conceived me in secret.
Well, no, I think changeling would mean foreigner or infiltrator or something like that.
Yeah, like I say, it's a very convoluted way of, it's not clear. That's right. That's not clear. And that's another thing you said just then when you were talking. There's loads of lines in this that are just completely ambiguous. It's like, well, what do you even mean by that?
Well, just sorry to interrupt the flow here, but we'll start this again because this is another thing that we've got to load this with. Because you were saying, like, we've lost things over the last 500 years. And it's like, the meaning of language itself and the way we describe the world has changed so radically since the days of Sargon. It's amazing we can draw anything from this. I mean, I watched a video the other day that was like, by the way, the ancient Egyptians didn't have a word for blue. They called the Mediterranean the Great Green. The word for blue is only a few hundred years old. The concept of blue as a color.
Wow, really?
Yeah, apparently. I mean, I didn't go through the original sources, so they might be wrong or whatever. But like, if that's the case, I mean, it shows you just how radically different the modern worldview is to the ancient worldview, right? And we have different concepts to describe presumably what are the same things. So again, like, it's the time, just the weight of time. You can feel it when you're reading through these things.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing to say about individual words, it's obviously an English translation, obviously, from cuneiform. So it's almost entirely up to the scholar who translated it to pick the words that I'm now reading.
And this has been through about three or four languages to get to us.
And whatever he picked, right, yeah. So it'll probably be a Babylonian.
Yeah.
Transcribing an actual Akkadian tablet.
Yes.
And then
presumably into Greek or something, because there's going to be some sort of Rosetta Stone of Babylonian and Greek or Egyptian to Greek and whatever. And so it's a long chain of descriptions.
And then some 19th century or early 20th century English scholar translating it, and the words he picks are now what I'm reading.
Yes.
So it's like what the original thing was or meant.
Yeah. I mean, we can't
be confident that
there are going to be certain things we can be fairly confident of. Words like father, probably fairly universal in the human experience. The Euphrates, probably relatively accurate. The city Azu Piranu, probably, but we don't know anything about it.
Because it's a proper name.
Yeah, because it's a proper name.
Can you really be one thing?
Exactly. But the emotional words that carry implication and intonation and describe more than one thing in more than one way, they're going to be totally suspect. And it's not the translator's fault either. There's nothing they could have done.
Right, yeah. If they're going to translate, they've got to say something.
Yeah.
So
the concept of gardener, we assume, means gardener in the way that we think of it. It might mean some sacred office or something like that, of someone who is ordering a replica of the universe so that the king can find tranquility and alignment with the stars or something. We don't know, you know.
Who knows, right?
And it's honestly, that's not an unrealistic assessment that I've just given either, even though I just pulled it off the top of my head. It might actually be that that's how they envisage these things. Because remember, having a garden 4,500 years ago was a remarkable feat in the middle of the desert. So, you know, this is genuinely like a heavenly thing. I mean, like I said, I've just made that up, but actually that might be more accurate to just the way that you as a, like, you know, an Englishman looking at your little back garden is thinking about it, you know?
Yeah. In our world, a gardener is not a big deal.
No.
It's what retired people do.
Yes.
Little old ladies spend time tending their garden.
Yeah.
Whereas in those days, a gardener might be a really important position in society, you know, like, or later, a bit later, the term a cupbearer comes up.
Yeah.
We would think perhaps in sort of high medieval times, a cupbearer is something a 16-year-old kid does.
Wow.
Or someone, it's not that important, but it's obviously really important in their world to be a cupbearer.
But it was
whatever
also,
that means.
It was important in the Middle Ages, actually.
Might be a very low rung on something.
But you were in direct contact with the king every day.
Okay, right. That's not to be sniffed at, absolutely.
Absolutely not. You know, you got to hear the privileged conversations. So, but to us, it sounds like a servile position.
Right, yeah. You might think, yes, a servant, isn't it?
No, a servant's in the fields ploughing. You know, I'm literally, I pour libations to the king. You know, like they would have had a totally different view on society to us, basically.
Mm. Seems like a cupbearer might be something very high up.
It is very high up.
Right, okay.
It's probably like the king's right-hand man.
Possibly, yeah.
You know, that's how it comes across when you're reading the sort of Akkadian sources.
Yeah.
So it would have been a very competitive position. Because, he becomes the cupbearer to the Gal Zagazi, doesn't he?
The king of...
King of Kish.
Who's called Usababa.
Ah, yes.
I'll get to him in a sec. So if I just quickly finish reading the inscription about his mother.
It's been a few years since I've read this.
Yeah.
But it is such a fun story. Sorry.
So he said, my high priestess mother conceived me and in secret bore me.
Sorry, just to pause again. Right, so I'm pausing on all of this because there's so much here. Why would she need to bear him in secret, right? Because as far as we can tell, these aren't Vestal virgins like in Rome, right?
Who knows?
Because
mightn't it?
Well, yeah, but we do also know that the Babylonians had temple prostitutes, right? So, there's no particular reason to think there's not a continuity of tradition here. And so it's likely that the Sumerians did the same thing. It's unlikely that the Babylonians just invented this out of whole cloth. It's probably something the Sumerians did. So why would the high priestess feel the need to...
And it's difficult to go, the reality, isn't it? It's difficult to go through a full pregnancy, have a baby, get rid of it, and no one knows, and you're clean and away. Like, that's not all that likely, is it?
Especially, it's not like you can, you're living in Iraq. You can't exactly cover yourself with thick woolen clothes, being like, yeah, it's winter, isn't it? I'm so cold. You know, you can't do that. So how did she do it? You know?
You're quite right that there's a tradition of sort of priestly prostitutes.
Yeah, it's totally normal.
There's all sorts of cults that are hedonistic and highly sexualized.
From the East.
But lots of them aren't, though, also. Sure. The idea of like the Vestal Virgin, it's not unique to Rome. Quite often priestesses and priests are supposed to be chaste. We just don't know. We just don't know.
But the implication, if she has to bear him in secret, implies that she had to be chaste, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
So
it's a shame on some level to her, obviously.
Yeah, exactly, right. And the only reason I'm going through all of this is just so we can try and tease out through implication. But again, that's assuming that the translation actually means anything that it's supposed to.
And that's all you can do with sort of ancient Sumerian, ancient Akkadian, is tease out things and guess and postulate potential likelihoods and stuff.
So it seems that the mother was meant to be some sort of high priestess who was also meant to be a sacred virgin. She fell in love with someone. Nature happened, took its course. She got pregnant and it's like, right, okay, I've got to...
A rapey uncle. Who knows what happened, right? Yeah. I mean, honestly, I mean, I'm not too crude about it. Who knows?
I was putting a more positive shine on it.
Yeah. But still, I mean, she obviously she didn't want him, but didn't want to just expose him, because that's the other thing we've mentioned in the past, is that you can just expose your baby.
Yeah,
you know, the modern equivalent is putting it in a dumpster and walking away.
Yeah,
that you can say to yourself, I didn't kill it, I didn't murder it, I let sort of fate decide what would happen to it. Hopefully, someone else will find it, but whether it's not my problem anymore.
Yeah.
It's also terrible, but people do it.
As a father of a 3-week-old baby, I'm telling you, if you expose your baby, you're killing it. You know it's going to die.
If you put it in a basket and throw it out on the Euphrates, it's going to die. It's very likely it's going to die.
It's very likely.
But of course, in this case, he didn't. Because we're told, she set me in a basket of rushes. With bitumen, she sealed my lid. She cast me into the river, which did not rise over me. The river bore me up and carried me to Aki, not to be confused with purple Aki, the drawer of water. Aki, the drawer of water, took me as his son and reared me. Aki, the drawer of water, appointed me as his gardener. While I was gardener, Ishtar granted me her love, female god Ishtar. And for 4 years, I exercised kingship. So there's a massive leap there.
There's a lot to be said.
Yeah.
Right. Okay,
but basically, he was found
and
saved. Mm. So he's an orphan. He's a nobody.
How does he know that his mother was a high priestess?
Don't know.
How could he know that?
I don't know. Okay. One thing to say right now is that there's loads and loads, there really are lots of different traditions of the Sargon story.
Yeah.
Just like loads of these people, like Romulus and Remus, like Theseus, like Lycurgus. There's multiple stories. Some say, most of them say, he had no idea who his father was. And one or two of them say, no, his dad was this guy.
Yeah.
He's a name.
Yeah.
So,
but from what we've been given here, Sargon can't possibly know who his mother was.
Right.
He can't possibly know she was a high priestess.
Yeah. Maybe in adulthood, you like trying to find your birth parents. In adulthood, you seek it out and do the research. We don't know any of that.
What could he have done?
We don't know. No idea. No idea. I mean,
How does he know that his city is Azu Piranu? How does he know?
Well, this inscription does come from Babylonian times, much later, so it's probably just made up.
Sure.
But it's all we've got. So
but it's obviously going to be the inherited legend that is, you know, the common knowledge is, well, Sargon was taken down the river to Aki, who's the gardener, and somehow he became the king of Kish.
Yeah.
Just happens.
So that's what it is. So he's taken to Kish, which is an Akkadian city, i.e. central or northern Iraq, modern Iraq. So it's not Sumerian. It will have been heavily influenced by a Sumerian culture. At this point, the Sumerian culture was sort of all dominant, really.
I mean, the fact it is a city implies that the Semitic Akkadians were looking at the non-Semitic Sumerians and saying, wow, they're doing great. And this is just a common theme, actually, through this region for thousands of years. Like the Semite Akkadians didn't really innovate all that much. They really just kind of adopted whatever the Sumerians had done, which is totally reasonable because Sumerians clearly had a great thing going on.
Yeah, the archaeology shows that the northern Akkadians just copied, for want of a better word, they just copied the Sumerians and did it less well. So you can see the original Sumerian stuff is of really high quality, certainly before they started mass producing it.
The only thing that the northerners seem to have been better than the southerners at is war, actually.
Yeah. And Sargon really encapsulates that. That shows up.
Yeah,
absolutely. That they're just better at organisation, if nothing else, and actual fighting in all sorts of ways. So the king is a chap called Usababa. He's the king of Kish,
and he's the one who's sick.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, well, we think maybe he was sick.
Well, we're told.
One thing, just to say, super quick on that. You know this idea that people like Mary Beard would like to say that there's sort of no women, no female political voices. There's one here which I think is great. Usababa is supposed to be the grandson of a woman called Kubaba. And this Kubaba we know very little about. There's a few lines.
Yeah.
But she seems great. She was just described as the owner of a tavern in Kish. So this woman who had property in her own right, because Sumerians and Akkadians, if you were free-born, as long as you weren't a slave, women had nearly the same rights as men, very nearly the same rights as men. And anyway, you can only infer that this Kubaba woman who owned a tavern also became, well, she did also become some sort of de facto ruler of Kish. And she's credited with making Kish's walls strong and all, things like this. And so, again, you can only imagine sort of quite plainly, just a badass woman who threw herself into the world of men and swam.
Just competent.
Completely competent, yeah.
Because, like, I mean, if she spends, say, you know, 15 years managing a tavern and the city's falling apart around, saying, no, you need to do this, you need to do that. She's obviously used to managing things.
I don't know if there's any sort of prostitution angle to it, but you imagine the cliche of a very, very strong-willed madam in the Wild West that just takes no crap from anyone ever, including gunslingers.
What was
that type of woman?
What was Pericles' wife called? What was her name?
Pericles' wife.
Because she was a prostitute who owned a bunch of taverns, who owned a bunch of brothels. And and Pericles adored her because she was so smart and headstrong. Everyone hated her. But I can't remember her name now.
I'm now thinking of Big Nose Kate, Doc Holliday's woman.
Yeah. There's loads of examples of this.
Would just lock horns with killers.
Yeah.
Right? And she just was fearless and competent and all sorts of things. Seems like Usababa's grandmother was one of those women.
Yep.
And successful in the realm of politics, obviously. And this is from some of the earliest times. So Mary Beard, to say that women never had any political voices ever, it's just absolute nonsense, isn't it?
I can't imagine that, you know, Sargon's mother, a high priestess, had nothing to say either.
Right.
Like, these are really important positions in society.
Yeah.
They're really important.
Okay, so at some point, and this is what we really don't know, when Sargon grows up or becomes a young man, he must have still been young.
Yeah.
Somehow becomes the cupbearer for Usababa. And again, it seems like it's something like, whether it's the king's actual right-hand man, but it's certainly a fairly senior position in the state.
So just to again, like, go through this. I think it's possible that the royal household was not nearly as big as we think of royal households as being today. Because every chance that Kish is probably about 20,000 people at most, right?
No, it's going to be in that sort of ballpark.
So, which is very big for nearly 5,000 years ago, but it's very small in the grand scheme of things now. So the royal household probably isn't that vast. And so this is why, like, being the royal gardener actually is quite a prestigious position. It's not like how we think of gardeners now, right? So it's something that there would have been honours attached to, and if Sargon's lucky enough to be raised as an adopted son into that family, well, why not? If he's a useful, you know, responsible young man or something, well, you know, Usababa needs a cupbearer, so, you know, you've been raised in the royal household since you were a baby. You were lucky enough to be gain entrance to it, basically.
Mm. Where I said in the state, I mean the city, the city state.
The state is a very generous
It's a very grand thing to say, isn't it, for it? Because if it's if Kish is, you know, in the order of 10, 20,000, something of that order, so the state is a few dozen streets.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The royal court is not a very big palace.
No.
Right, yeah. So
made of mud brick.
So, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mud brick and straw. So if you're... Yeah. Given a position, no matter how senior or junior it is, you'd be quite lucky, but it's not mad that this adopted child that was found in a basket floating down the Euphrates could... Well, this is the thing you can sort of infer, is that Usababa, or someone right at the very, very top of the state, just saw the young Sargon and saw something in him, so that he's capable or whatever, and just said, let's throw this kid a bone. Let's give him a chance.
Or
that's all really.
Another way of looking at it is, it's entirely possible that Usababa is looking at his nobles who are constantly vying and jostling for position and would like to, say, get close to the king, and thinks he doesn't trust any of them. Right. And actually, maybe this orphan boy who has no emotional and, you know, sentimental ties to maybe these sus nobles is actually a more reliable prospect, because he's not going to poison me on behalf of his uncle who wants to become the king.
Right.
So this kid has got no particular ties apart from Aki, who's just my gardener, who likes me, obviously. So who knows? You know, we've got to make up these stories because we just don't know. But that's another way of it could have been.
So there's two things you can do if you're sort of a king in ancient times or even medieval times. You can make all the people around you members of your own family or your own kinship group, or you can go the opposite with it and make sure there's no one in your family near you. Both have got advantages and disadvantages. Sometimes it works out for people if you can trust your own family, your own kin group, but often, because of sort of all sorts of reasons, sort of blood feuds and all sorts of things, as might be the worst thing you could do.
Envy.
Yeah, right, you know, right. Yeah.
Bitterness.
Yeah, yeah.
Jealousy.
Who knows?
Yeah.
So at some point, we're told, the king, Usababa, has some sort of dream, perhaps just a premonition, some sort of idea. We're told he basically gets scared of Sargon. He's worried. Maybe because the kid is so ambitious or so brilliant.
Or competent, yeah.
Competent. Some people, even when they're very young, even when they're teenagers or in their late teens, they're sort of highly competent.
Yeah.
Some people hit the ground running in life like that. What? I didn't. I was still a complete idiot when I was like useless. 22. But some people are, you know, when they're 17, they can control men when they're that young. Some people...
Thing that comes across when I was reading these years ago was the figure of Sargon is... described in a way, in a method that brings across this kind of self-assuredness, right? And now, it's not surprising, given that this is the story of Sargon, that this would be transposed back onto the youth that was, you know, that become the king. But there's a kind of robustness to the character of him, that he doesn't, he's not flighty, he doesn't break down to tears, he's not scared. The people around him are scared. You know, Lugal, Zagazi, Usababa, they're nervous and insecure, but Sargon feels like this kind of pillar in the story, and obviously because it's about him, unsurprisingly. I'm not saying this is real or not, but it's the way it comes across. So it's entirely possible that he was one of these people who was just, I mean, he didn't have any advantages, right? So it's not like he's got a doting mother. He can, you know, he's going to have worked since his earliest youth, because you're an adopted child. You're going to go to tend the garden at 5 years old, or whatever. You know, obviously child labor is just what they did. So he probably was going to be more mature than other people of his own age.
A bit like Napoleon, maybe had something to prove.
Yeah.
Did have something to prove.
Absolutely.
Just did have something to prove. If you're ambitious, if you want to get to the top, and you're sort of an orphan, and you're sort of in the peripheries of a royal court, you've got to work hard. You've got to be lucky as well, all sorts of things. But there are people in history like Napoleon, brought himself up by his bootstraps.
Yep.
Another way to describe it, really.
Yeah. There are lots of people like that as well. Mm. I'm brought to mind of Agathocles of Syracuse again. We're going to have to do one on him, because again, he's just like, he shouldn't have been anything. And yet, but another thing as well, we are not talking about the power of religion in this time period, which is something that we are definitely missing one angle of, because of course the story of Sargon is infused with gods who are coming down and interfering in the affairs of men. And this is something that happens all through history, but the modern eye, the modern mind, has trouble understanding what this is supposed to mean and how to interpret it. And I think it is true that they did perceive gods, right? I mean, running back from Marathon, the runners, Pheidippides, I think it was supposed to have seen a god on the road, right? Now, obviously, in reality, a deity didn't appear to him in the road. However, if you've run 100 miles and you believe these things exist, maybe you're a bit hungry, you're thirsty, and because of your cultural background, you do see something like this, right? And so when you get to Athens, you report God appeared to me in the road. Well, everyone thinks, well, that probably did happen, right? And so if the king of Kish is having dreams about gods who are interceding in the affairs of men, and Sargon says, I had a dream about a god, Ishtar came to me and said I was her favored, it's entirely possible that the people in the civilization believe it, because that will to them seem like corroborating evidence. You know, they will, because they believe the world is infused with magic and that the gods do appear in your dreams and do tell you about what's going to happen in the future. And so it seems preposterous from the modern mind, but really all of this is the decision making of men influenced by their irrational faculties, basically.
Yeah, the gods play Ishtar and Enlil. It seems like the god Enlil, Sargon had a particular affinity with. But yeah, people even, I think of Joan of Arc, for example, claimed that God spoke to her. And I am absolutely convinced that she was genuinely convinced.
She wasn't making up.
Right.
Yeah. She wasn't being cynical.
Well, even to this day, people, Jehovah's Witnesses and things, all sorts of different people claim they do speak to God, or God speaks to them, to this day, right?
Yeah.
So back in the deep past, it makes complete sense.
And there's no other way of explaining the universe as well to these people. Mm. That's the thing, because we have another way of explaining the universe. But if you don't have another way of explaining the universe, and you've been raised since your earliest times, your grandparents, or their grandparents, have always said, the gods do this, the gods do that, and this is how the world works. And then you have a vision or a dream of a god who says to you in this booming intonation, you will become the king. Why would you not believe that? You personally, if you lived then, you would believe it too. I would believe it, you would believe it, even if in the modern era we don't believe it. It's not their fault either.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.